Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. Our guest on this episode is one of our favorites. She was one of our first panelists on our first ever show. You see her on CNN about 85 times a day. You've seen her on The Doctors. You've seen her on Dr. Phil. You've seen her on Let's Face the Truth. You've seen her all over the place. Her name is Areva Martin. She's a Harvard-educated powerhouse attorney who has become one of the most important voices out there, and we're excited to have her. Hey, Areva.
Hey, Alec. Thank you. I can't believe we are, what, a year out from the start date, the inaugural show for The Issue Is? Congratulations.
It's exactly 1 year that we started, and I'm so grateful that you were here for the first show.
Well, thank you, and congratulations to you for bringing just great television and helping folks in Los Angeles and across the country understand what's going on in our political system right now, because it's a lot going on and it can be really confusing. So shows like yours really help, I think, bring clarity.
Well, thank you for saying that, and thank you for helping us do that, and thank you for being one of the best minds out there.
You are welcome.
And so I think on the TV version of the show, we get a limited amount of time, but here we get more of a chance to sort of get to know you and get to know why you're interested in this. And let's sort of start from the beginning. Where does your passion for these issues come from? Talk to us about your childhood a little bit.
Yeah, I think my passion, well, I know my passion for these issues just, emanates from my upbringing. I grew up in a housing project in North St. Louis, and I got to see a lot of the injustices that we talk about on national television, or that I talk about on national television. And it's different when you talk about them from kind of an ivory tower level, and then you actually experience it either because you live in that environment or you work in that environment. So for me, it's not just talking about statistics and how laws impact people. It's really coming from a place of having experienced what it's like to be in a community that has suffered injustices, a community where, the poverty rate is, above the national average, where you do have more African-American men in particular in jail than you have in college, where you have people living on below, substandard wages, barely making it, single moms, grandparents stepping in, fill the void for parents who aren't there, high rates of drug addiction. So all of those things that, I talk about in my legal and political commentary, in some ways, I've experienced it, and not only because of my upbringing, but because of the work that I now do, too, as a nonprofit leader. I get to work in some of the most vulnerable communities across the state of California, and, it makes the conversation real.
You have the interesting perspective, which most people don't, of now living on the west side of Los Angeles with your husband due to your incredible hard work and success, but then also having this experience of a childhood in a very different world. Now living in this other world, what do you think people living in that world don't get about the housing project world?
Well, I think it's easy to just believe what you hear in the media, and that's the unfortunate part. I just participated in, I helped some young students in high school who were writing an essay about black hair. And their feelings as if because they wear their hair natural that they are demonized at their schools, that they're looked down upon, that they're thought to be less smart, less sophisticated, and just overall less than their counterparts. And a lot of that is shaped because of the images we see in the media. So I think when you live in, the world of affluence and whatever that is, however you define that, that it's very easy to get a picture in your mind about how, the other side of the track lives, and it's not always accurate. In fact, oftentimes, and more often than not, it's inaccurate. And people, they take those images that they see in the media, and then they use that as the basis either for policy decisions, for funding decisions, or just how they even, vote in political elections, whether they're local or national. So what I want people to know is if you're going to really have a true understanding of how other people live, you got to walk in their shoes. So if you're voting or talking about health care and you've always had access to the highest quality of healthcare, you would, you know, do yourself a service by getting to know, talking to, having an understanding of how someone who doesn't have access to healthcare, you know, what their fears, what their concerns are, you know, just about even having something as simple as a, you know, a cold that may turn to pneumonia and the fear about not being able to get antibiotics because they don't have a healthcare plan.
I mean, isn't the extraordinary thing about so many communities, but especially Southern California, that so many of these communities are so close to each other, and yet it's like a wall is up, that people from Watts may never talk to people from Brentwood, or people from West LA have never talked to somebody from Riverside. And so there really isn't that understanding of the way people live 2-3 minutes away.
Not only, Alec, have they not only talked to, they've never even driven in those communities. And you're right. You know, we're divided in Southern California by this great system of freeways and highways, but it does serve as a physical barrier. And I've worked with people in West LA, in the West Valley, and we talk about, or we may have, you know, have a conversation about South Los Angeles, and they don't have a clue about it because they've never even driven there. Maybe it's 15 minutes, 20 minutes away. So I would encourage folk that, you know, really want to be in, or people who are engaged in the political process, who are engaged in the fundraising or nonprofit worlds, or just, you know, who have a interest in helping people, you know, get in your car and drive south. You know, get in your car and drive east and see some of these communities and meet the people that live in these communities, because I think you'll have a very different opinion, and it will change the way you think about things that, you know, opinions I think that are widely formed just by reading about communities and not actually experiencing those communities.
And that's one of the great joys. I feel so lucky being a field reporter for so long is literally being forced to go to all these different communities and meeting the greatest people and having great food.
Yeah. Well, there's no shortage of great food, although I love New York, and New Yorkers think that L.A. doesn't have good food, but we can disabuse them of that you know, misconception, because we do have good food. But, we, you know, there's great communities throughout Southern California. And again, I think if you're in your bubble, in your West Side bubble or your West, you know, Valley bubble, you're missing out on some really incredible communities and cultural events and things that are happening throughout Southern California.
So let's take you back to St. Louis, where you grew up. When's the moment when you thought, I want to be an attorney? That's what I want to do.
Yeah, I don't know if it happened in a moment as much as it happened over a period of me just witnessing what, again, I call these injustices. I didn't know the name. I couldn't put a label on them. But I knew that people in my community had different experiences. And to me, it didn't feel right. And I was always that inquisitive child that asked a lot of questions like, how come? And I went to this prestigious all-girls high school in St. Louis. And I don't know how prestigious it was. It was an all-girl Catholic high school. And I had to catch a couple of buses from my neighborhood to get there. And that was my awakening, driving or riding on these buses through these neighborhoods. My godmother worked as a janitor. And I often tell this story how I used to go with her as a kid, a 10-year-old, 11-year-old kid. And we would go to these affluent suburbs outside of St. Louis, and she would clean offices, and I would help her. And again, that was my exposure to that. There was a whole, you know, other world outside of my housing project, and it just didn't seem right to me that people got to live in that other world, and they weren't in many ways different than the kids and the families that I grew up with, but yet there was this big divide. And unfortunately, St. Louis remains a very segregated city, as is a lot of our big cities, where, you know, people of different ethnicities and races, they live on one part of the, on one side of the city, and the others, you know, people live on the other side. And there isn't as much integration in these communities as you would like or you would think in 2019.
You went to Harvard.
I did, law school.
Did you feel at home there? What was that like being in that world, the most prestigious of worlds, especially coming from the world that you're describing?
Well, I was ready for it. It would have been very, very different, but for an awakening experience I had at the University of Chicago when I went to college. So University of Chicago was that stark contrast, was that world that really, it was a do or die, you know, make or break moment for me when I got to the University of Chicago. You know, really, really, if you don't know anything about this school, check it out. I don't know. It's 1, 2, 3 on, you know, U.S. World Report in terms of top colleges. Not an Ivy League school, but You know, probably more Nobel Peace Prize winners have come from that school than most. It's a pre-med school. Most of the folks there are going into science, and not med like, you know, patient care, but med like we're going to find the cure for cancer, like the biggest brains, the biggest scientists, the smartest people on the planet go to that school. And a really, really intimidating experience for me when I arrived. I was like a fish out of water. It was a cultural nightmare for me. I was so unlike the students there, not only because of the socioeconomics, but we're talking third, fourth generation legacy students whose parents were, again, not just doctors, and I have a lot of respect for doctors, but these were like the folks that ran the biggest, you know, brain trust and institutions in this country. And I had this experience with this upper class woman. She shamed me for the way that I talked. And I went, I just stopped talking for about a whole school semester. I was so humiliated. I was so ashamed. And I had to go remake the way that I talked. And that whole freshman year at the University of Chicago really, you know, challenged me, tested my grit, my fortitude. And, you know, so I overcame it. I did what I had to do. I ended up graduating from the University of Chicago magna cum laude. So despite the first year that was rocky and horrible, and I cried most of the nights and, you know, wanted to give up and wanted to give in, I realized that I had something that could level the playing field for me. And that was a strong, very strong work ethic. Mm-hmm. So spending those nights with my godmother as a janitor, cleaning those offices, really taught me a lot. And watching my godmother, who had three jobs and made it on so very little, it taught me about hard work. And that's my mantra today. You cannot outwork me. I just won't be outworked. And that's what I learned at the University of Chicago. I didn't have the pedigree. I didn't have the, you know, I wasn't valedictorian of my high school class. I didn't have the socioeconomic background. And I didn't have a lot of the things that the students had. But I realized that I could pull 12 or 14 hours in a library. And very few people, I don't care how smart you are, how rich you are, that separates the men from the boys, or the you know, right. You have to put on your big girl's panties to do that. And so I was able to do that. And I realized that that was kind of my ticket to being successful in that environment. And I soared. I found my voice, which is funny to me that today I make my living talking, because literally I was a shy. I wasn't shy. I was just, from that experience with this woman, I was intimidated. I was fearful. I thought I could not speak publicly without being, you know, shamed or laughed at or humiliated. So I tell that story a lot to tell people, you know, what some people see as your deficit may be your greatest asset.
Yeah.
And so by the time I got to Harvard, I had those experiences. So I was ready. I was ready for Harvard. I didn't bother me again that I was going to be with all these legacy students, you know, many of them daughters and sons of judges, many of them daughters and sons of senators and congresspeople and governors and, you know, some of the top political folks in our country, some of the, you know, daughters and sons of CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, because that's who goes to Harvard. And then there are folks like me that also go to Harvard. Mm-hmm. We're in the minority, but it was a great experience. I excelled there, graduated with honors again, met some wonderful people, had some great experiences there.
Have you ever talked to that woman again?
You know, I have not. It's funny because I have a couple of really good friends that I met in college, and we laugh about it because they know about it. So I love Chicago. I go back there frequently, and I have a couple of really good college friends that I'm in touch with. So we kind of chuckle about that experience.
Do you have a fantasy that that woman watches you on CNN and is sitting fat in a basement somewhere and just thinking, oh, she's done it?
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that, because I had a friend who literally knew me in fifth grade, found me on LinkedIn, and told me that he used to tell his daughter about us going to this little neighborhood school in this housing project, and, you know, teaching his daughter lessons about hard work and resiliency and, you know, perseverance. And he would tell his daughter my name. And his daughter called him, he said, one night, like, you know, all excited, said, Dad, this woman you've been telling me about, she's on TV. And he runs into his room, and there I am, yes, on CNN, talking about something. And he's like, oh, my God. And so he gets in touch with me. And I had not seen this man since the fifth grade, and he's done very well. He's some big executive at a big insurance company. He's married, has kids. And we had a chance to go to lunch about a month ago. And I'm just, it was so shocking to me. So, yes, that woman, her name is Angela. I'll say her name. I don't know. I won't say her last name, but that was her first name. So, yes, she or her children or someone that she knows might be watching me and may have a similar experience as Timothy Brown, which is the friend from fifth grade who, you know, we've reconnected because of that experience.
Did you, so Harvard Law, did you know Barack Obama? Were you close in anything at all or that?
No. I was not there. Barack Obama graduated after me. He's older than I am, but he took some time off from college.
He was in from 91 or something when he graduated, right?
Yeah, he graduated Columbia, I think, and then went and did some work outside of, you know, he did some work. He had some body of work before he then went to law school. But I was in law school with Michelle Obama.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And we served on a couple of boards together. We were on a committee where we planned a reunion for black Harvard alumni. And we were on a law journal together called the Black Letter Journal, which was a journal that was dedicated to, you know, academic or legal discourse about issues that impacted African-American communities. And one of the many books that have been written about her, I had a chance to be interviewed and give some input and send some photographs. So, yeah, I did have that experience. And she also from Chicago, worked in Chicago. So we have this whole network of friends that were in the law school. She went to Princeton, Harvard. And one of my very closest friends and board members of my nonprofit is also Princeton, Harvard. So lots of connections.
And just this week, she was here at UCLA doing a big national college signing day, which is such a cool thing. They had like 10,000 students that they celebrated from high school. She wore a Compton College shirt, which was a big celebration for people in Compton. So the question has to be, what was she like in college? What was Michelle like? Something was special?
Everybody at Harvard is likely to do something incredible. What that is, you know, who knows? So Michelle was special in the way that I think many of the graduates there are. Michelle Granholm is the former governor of Michigan. She was
Jennifer
was in our class as well. And you can go down a roster of, you know, very successful people. So Michelle was, you know, bright and bubbly and destined for greatness. And it's just amazing to see her, particularly, you know, now with her book, her memoir being like the best-selling book ever in the history of memoirs. And so she's just, you know, phenomenal.
I think she's getting close to the Bible in sales.
Yeah, it's going to get there if not already. That book is just soaring and still people, you know, from not just nationally, international, you know, book events, which, you know, we haven't seen anyone, which is ironic because her book came out before the president. So now the question is, how will his book do, you know, when it hits the stands next year or this year? So,
well, if you look at opinion polls, she's more beloved than he is.
I mean, yeah.
She's one of the most popular, perhaps the most popular public figure in the country.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And, you know, I think she earned it. I mean, she was an incredible first lady. And we have to think back to how her journey started, you know, as first lady. You think about some of those ugly, you know, cartoons and commentary and social media posts and some of the, you know, the vile language and just attacks that were made on her that were really, really ugly and very nasty. And she just kept rising above all the, you know, the hate, I think, that was directed at her and prove that, you know, you can be above reproach and still be very strong, very opinionated, and, you know, be effective, which is what she was, effective.
Yeah. And speaking of Harvard, my friend Brian Goldsmith, who's a frequent panelist, I don't know if you've been on the show with him before. I think he's going to be our guest on the podcast next week. He went to Harvard with Mayor Pete at the same time. And
wonderful.
He was in
undergrad.
He was in class with him undergrad.
Yeah.
And said at the time he was dating women.
Really?
He was somebody who was, they thought, the most ambitious person they knew. And they all thought that he would run for president.
Wow.
As a straight man. And that, but they never thought he would run for president at 37. You know, and they're all, so he's
Were Brian, they shocked or not yeah, shocked, but
they
surprised
were
surpri- when he
yeah, they were surprised.
You know, came and, out and, yeah. in terms of his sexual orientation?
Yeah. And they, so Brian's going to be hosting a fundraiser for him at his house next Thursday night. And
yeah,
we're talking about it next Friday on the show.
That's, you know, segue into this 2020, you know, the presidential field, the incredible talent that the Democratic, you know, side has in terms of candidates for 2020, just unbelievable. And I watched Bennett, Senator Bennett,
get Michael, in, Bennett,
Michael Bennett,
Senator from Colorado,
get into the race. And I remembered his epic speech about Ted Cruz's crocodile tears, and they played that again, and he did an interview on, you know, one of the cable stations, and just very bright, very thoughtful. So we've got a really strong, you know, roster of folks who are running.
So why Kamala? Because that's who you're backing.
Yeah. No, Kamala is amazing. She had a great week. If you, you know, live on this planet and you were watching, or either you're, you know, tuned into your social media, you saw what happened with the bar hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee. You know, she showed her prowess as a prosecutor and just, again, a very thoughtful senator. I think she represents where the Democratic Party is today. I think the party is more diverse than ever. I think the party is looking for diverse, you know, leadership. And I think she represents that. You know, she has a strong background as a prosecutor. She has been outspoken on issues that I think the Democratic base cares about. She's introduced some really, I think, innovative policy positions. And, you know, one of the terms they use now often is, and you and I just talked about this earlier, about there being no there there. I think, you know, without doubt for her, there is lots of there there. And that's why she's in the top 5-7, you know, ranking of candidates. And she has been since she announced, and she has continued to be, you know, a top candidate.
You know, one of the most important demographics, voting demographics in the Democratic Party is African-American women. They've been the key to a lot of success during the midterms. And if they get behind her in the early states, especially places like South Carolina, places like California, Nevada, other states that are out there, not as many in Iowa and New Hampshire, I mean, that's her. That's a pretty good lane, right?
Oh, it's an excellent lane to be in. And, you know, obviously, though, when you have 20 candidates, 20-plus candidates, it's hard to think about, you know, it's going to be challenging for any candidate, including a candidate like Kamala Harris, because we've got to consolidate that vote. And, you know, that's what the team is working every day hard to do and working hard every day to do. And we've done an outstanding job so far. And I think the momentum that she's gaining will just continue in, like you said, some of those key southern states. And I think there is a pathway, obviously, for a candidate like her with her talent, with her skills, and not just with African-American women, because I think it's too narrow to think that she's just a candidate that appeals to African-American women. Obviously, she's not. She has cross appeal. And you're not going to win this election just with African-American voters,
right?
Because once you swing out the South, that's pretty much it in terms of, you know, where African-Americans have a large, you know, there's some urban areas, you know, in the Midwest, obviously, but I think it's a mistake for us to, and I don't like pundits who, and not suggesting that you did that, but some of the pundits, you know, tend to talk about her only in the context of African-American voters, and that's not fair.
No, and that's not the way she won in this state. She's
absolutely,
one of the most popular people in one of the most diverse states possible.
Absolutely.
My point being, though, that in a field of 22, the vote's going to get divided up a lot. Right.
Yes.
And so you need to have a strong base or lane. And even if that base or lane is 10%, 12%, 20%, that could be enough to win. And if she's able to lock that base down, that could be very helpful to her.
Oh, absolutely. And that's a part of the strategy. And the strategy has always been, and she's been to South Carolina multiple times. She's gotten really key endorsements in that state. And obviously, California, I think there's no question that she will carry California. And Nevada being so close to California is also
Although the polls show she's not ahead in California right now.
That's interesting. Well, I think it's early. Yeah. Some of those polls,
polls. Yeah, yeah, we'll see.
We've learned a lot about those polls because some of those polls still say things like, we don't know who our senator is. We don't know her. I mean, I've seen polls from California that people still say they don't know who she is. And I'm like, oh, my God, what planet do you live on?
Yeah.
You know, she's gotten major, major national press. She's on the cover of the L.A. Times, which is, you know, the biggest county in California, pretty much weekly. So, you know, we'll see things start to change. There's going to be the debates coming up in June. And I think those debates will give her an opportunity to shine. She'll be outstanding, no doubt, in my mind, on the stage with the other candidates. It's going to be interesting to see 22 candidates debate each other, but that's going to be an opportunity for candidates to make their mark. And, you know, if these debates are indicative of you know, the candidates that will continue to be in the top group, I have no doubt that she'll be, you know, in that top five. Going and strong. And let's remember this. This, when you have such a crowded field, money, organization, team, all of those things matter. You know, who's going to be able to go the distance? I mean, are all 22 of these candidates going to be around coming out of the summer? You know, Elizabeth Warren, great candidate, lots of great policy. But, you know, one of the reports that keep coming, that reports we keep seeing is about her burn rate. You know, that she's burning through a lot of her money. So a candidate that's going to make it the distance has to have a very disciplined campaign, has to have, you know, strong ground operation. And so far what the Harris team has put together, you know, speaks to the ability to do that, to go the distance, because that's what's going to matter. You know, the polls, early polls now, some of those folks, I don't even know if they'll be around come September, and definitely after the early, you know, primaries, the beginning of next year. You know, it's a very, very costly proposition.
Or even may not even last till then. A lot of last time around, people dropped out after the first debate.
Yeah, you know? So we may see
that. First debate's going to be on multiple nights because there's so many candidates. It's going to be a two-night affair.
You know, one of the things I've been contemplating, because people have been talking about who they'd like to see Trump debate. Do you think Trump is even going to do a debate? I've been thinking that he may pass because he's going to be upset that, you know, Fox isn't getting any of the Democratic, you know, primary debates as of yet. You know, the DNC has announced it's not going to do Fox debates. So, and that's Fox News, not Fox LA, obviously. But, you know, I've been pondering that.
It's an interesting question, depending on what position he's in. Although, of course, the presidential debates are not done by any one network. It's a group of all the networks. Last time, Chris Wallace of Fox News was one of the moderators. Did a fantastic job in that role, I thought. So we'll see.
Yeah,
and the president does like being on TV.
He does, but he also gets, you know, I don't know. I don't think that's a I'll put it like this. Based on everything we know about this president, it is not a foregone conclusion. And I think if he thinks it could hurt him more than help him, he will pass.
And we're starting to see some of that with what's happening in the Senate right now with you're just not going to respond to your subpoena.
Yeah, they have really turned tradition, you know, on its head and taken positions that we never thought plausible or possible. So I don't think we should think anything will be, you know, conventional or traditional about the 2020 election as long as Trump is the candidate, you know, for the Republicans.
Could you imagine the ratings, though, if he does it and it's either Trump versus Biden or Trump versus Harris or Trump versus Mayor Pete or Trump versus Warren? Just how many people would love to watch that on.
Yeah, but again, it's going to come down to whether Trump thinks it helps or hurts him. Because if he doesn't think, he's not going to do it if it helps the other side. Because, you know, that's not his game. His game is Trump is the king. Trump is the king. So I don't know. We may have to hold our breath for that one. That just may not happen.
Speaking of great TV, let's talk about how you got involved in TV. I remember we first met years ago when I was working at ABC7, and I think you were more early on in your TV punditry. I think you were doing some stuff for GMA, and we talked to you. I don't know if it was about Conrad Murray or what it was about.
Yeah, I remember that interview. It was kind of in a hallway at the studio there.
Yeah. And I was like, wow, she's so smart. She's so great. She should be a big national star. And then you became a big national star.
Well, thank you.
And I'm still
in
local
that.
News. But anyways, but the point being, sort of what, when did you first get involved in the TV game? Because you were a successful attorney before.
Yeah,
that.
I was a practicing civil rights attorney, civil litigator, had and continue to have a practice here in Los Angeles. I had some life-changing events. One, the birth of my son, but the diagnosis of my son with autism was really a life-changing event for me. I restructured my law practice to really focus on disability rights. I started representing more disabled individuals in my practice. I became heavily involved in legislative activity around disability rights and autism. I wrote a book. I took some time off to kind of reflect. And I got really into TV, not so much planned, but because of how I had shifted my practice. I was representing some families, about five families in Las Vegas, who had kids who were in a classroom, and they had most of these kids were nonverbal kids with autism, and they were abused in the classroom by a teacher. And it was the first time that the district attorney in the state of Nevada was charging a teacher with child abuse for activity that happened in a classroom. And the case got national attention, national news attention. And the Dr. Phil team wanted to have the clients on their show to talk about, you know, what it meant to be a parent of a kid with autism that was nonverbal, and then to learn that the teacher was abusing, you know, what was the emotional impact on these parents. And so my clients got invited onto the show, and I went onto the show with my clients to really talk about the lawsuit and, you know, just some of the issues around autism and what parents could do to make sure their kids were safe in the classroom. And that was really my first foray into television. And that show, the taping went so well that I got asked by one of Phil's producers to stick around and to do what's called B Show, when daytime talk shows are typically not live, they're taped. And typically multiple shows on a day. So my clients and I were on the A show, and I got asked to stick around to do the B show. And the B show was a conversation about Dog the Bounty Hunter using the N-word, and the question was, you know, should this show be canceled? Should a television personality, reality show person like Dog the Bounty Hunter, should he be allowed to stay on television because he was caught on these audio tapes? I guess it was his daughter who was dating a black guy, and, you know, it was all the news. And I didn't know the story because I was not a news junkie at that time and didn't read, you know, 1,200 newspapers all day, every day. And they asked me to stick around. They had an all-male panel. They wanted a female perspective. I was a mom. You know, I was an advocate at that time. And I said, sure. They brought me a big stack of news articles to read. And this is in between tapings. And I had to read, digest, formulate an opinion, and go out and have this conversation with some really heavy hitters who were on this panel for Dr. Phil. And it was scary. It was scary because this is only... The autism show was easier because I was talking about the lawsuit I had filed. So right. I knew it. I knew the ins and outs of it.
It's
I knew the law.
It's literally your baby.
It was literally my baby. I knew these clients. I could talk about it all day, all night. But this story that I was introduced to 30 minutes before I had to go out and formulate an opinion and then have an opinion. And it was so controversial, the N-word. You know, it's in rap songs. It's, you know, it's a layered, you know, very nuanced conversation to have, you know, whether you're having it in the African-American community or in a broader community. So I had to be very thoughtful and reflective about, you know, what I said. And Dr. Phil, you know, has this huge, huge audience. So I did it, and it went well, again, and a great taping. And what I realized when I left there was, one, that I had this ability to take huge amounts of material, digest them quickly, and then be able to interpret them and talk about them in a TV format, which is very much a soundbite, very quick format, which is very different than how lawyers talk and how we are thought to process information. Because, you know, the joke is lawyers get paid by how many words we write and speak.
Yeah.
And TV is the total opposite.
Joe Biden thinks that too. Yeah.
Yeah. TV is the opposite. Yeah, right. You know, you don't have a lot of time. You got to spit it out. You got to spit it out quickly. It's got to be impactful. And you got to be, you know, short. And I didn't know I had that talent, but I realized it. And then when the shows aired, got so much positive feedback. And it really said to me, wow, I can represent one client at a time. I could be incredibly successful. But there is something about being able to talk to millions of people. mm-hmm. about issues that I care about the law, about autism, about advocacy, about justice, about the N-word, and reach millions of people in a 30-minute or 60-minute segment that you can't do even when you have the biggest case on the planet. You know, it's literally as a plaintiff's attorney or as an attorney representing someone, you know, it's one case at a time. And that really was got me thinking about, you know, doing more TV. And in the Dr. Phil show, their team was great. They said, hey, you know, we'd love to have you back. So I started making more regular appearances on Dr. Phil, and I got to be, you know, pretty regular on that show. Cases I would bring, stories that they had. And then I kind of branched out, you know, off into the news part of it. So that was really how I got into television. And then, you know, as they say in Hollywood, the rest is history.
Right. You hosted The Doctors for a couple of years. You were.
From commentating to hosting.
Right. You were on the Face the Truth on CBS with Vivica Fox as well.
Vivica Fox, yes, and a team of other experts. And I.
And you're on CNN, seems like, four times a day.
And I continue to do my commentary on a range of, you know, shows, CNN, HLN, GMA. I continue to do GMA. Yeah. And world news and shows associated with GMA. So I get to have this voice. And that's what I think for me has been the most gratifying about my, you know, the evolution of my career.
And, of course, the issue is the best one.
The issue is fantastic.
Most annoying person you've ever faced off on TV?
Ooh, I won't name names, but one thing that happens on TV is, you know, because you have sometimes a 3-minute segment, right, and you get to answer one question, and that might be a 30 to 45 second soundbite. There's a lot of competition for the mic. And, you know, people want to one up you oftentimes. And I had this guy who disagreed with my opinion. We were on CNN. And so I don't know if he's being cute or he just wasn't listening, but he made like one of the biggest mistakes you make when you're in this format, which is he mispronounced my name.
Ooh.
And rather than try to correct himself, which, you know, you make mistakes like that in live television, you just make a correction. But I think he was doing it to kind of belittle and demean me.
What did he call you?
I don't even know. But it wasn't my name. And he was being, I think, cute, trying to be cute about it. And so then I got to, you know, have a response to what he said. And, you know, I corrected him politely. But, you know, it was, you know, kind of a TV check. And we do that in TV a lot. So I learned from that. And one thing I try not to do in TV is, and I've watched people do this, and it kind of annoys, it does annoy me, is they get personal. I was on a show once, and a woman literally started talking about someone's looks.
Mm.
And, you know, being really ugly and demeaning about the person's, you know, physical appearance. And I learned TV from the best, which is Dr. Phil, who's, you know, going into season 18 of, like, the number one talk show on television. And I got to be very close to him and learn from him. And, you know, before Face the Truth, which is a Stage 29 show, there was another show that I was a part of casted in that was a Stage 29 show. So I've been around that family for a long time in that production company and learned a lot about, you know, how to be effective on television. And, you know, you can be stern, you can be you know, persuasive. You can be funny. Obviously, on TV, you've got to be entertaining depending on, you know, the subject matter and the format of the show. But, you know, it was never about personal insults. And I don't do personal insults. And when I watch other people do them, you know, it just, I think, cheapens the brand.
Right.
One thing Dr. Phil was real keen on is, you know, doing things that are consistent with your brand. And, you know, now I've written a whole book about brands. You know, my book, Make It Rain, is about finding your voice and, you know, perfecting your authentic brand. And so I think that's important when you have a brand, you know, not to go beneath your brand, not to tarnish the brand, not to do anything that, you know, takes away from your brand, because that's your goodwill. That's what people come to know. That's what they come to trust. And you got to protect it.
And of course, Dr. Phil learned from the greatest of all time,
Oprah. So those lessons passed down.
Yeah. And so real quickly, and before we go, because I could talk to you for all day, but we got to go do the show. An important part of your brand is the work that you do on the Special Needs Network.
Yes.
And you mentioned your son who has autism.
Yes.
And you guys recently took a major step forward in Southern California.
Yes, we broke grounds on a 55,000-square-foot child and wellness center. It's on the campus of the Martin Luther King Hospital right in the heart of Watts Willowbrook community in South Los Angeles. And this is a $33 million project financed primarily primarily by the county, but it's a public-private partnership. The county will occupy the first floor. It'll be a medical hub for foster care children, which is great, and at-risk kids where they can get evaluations, have visits with their biological parents, and just get the support and help that they need. But the second floor, which is my baby, is going to be a state-of-the-art, first ever in the state, autism medical clinic. This whole floor will be all about diagnostic, both on the developmental side as well as the medical side, interventions, and a range of services and supports, from a legal clinic, a STEAM clinic, a community garden, life skills kitchen, a teen center, job training center, speech therapy, occupational therapy, music and dance therapy, but just everything that individual with special needs, whether it's autism, dyslexia, emotional, challenges, intellectual challenges, they'll be able to come to a facility beautifully built and constructed in the heart of South Los Angeles and get the support and help that they need.
Last question for me. What is the most important piece of advice you would give to a parent of a special needs kid?
Get help. Don't suffer alone. So often I find parents trying to make it on their own, isolating themselves, fearful of a diagnosis, feeling ashamed, feeling as if they did something wrong, and they haven't. And I would just tell them, seek help, because there's help out there, and there are networks like mine and others that provide support and resources and services. You don't have to go at this alone.
Well, you can get some of that help at the Special Needs Network, which Areva is the president of. Congratulations on that. Thank you for what you do. Her book is called Make It Rain, which
yes.
You can order everywhere you can buy a book.
Yes.
We thank you. You can hear her on The Issue Is on the TV version of this podcast, which is also going to be dropping soon here as well. And on our past podcast, which you can go back through right here on The Issue Is podcast. We hope that you subscribe. We thank you so much for listening. Thank you for your support throughout year one. And here's to year two. Thanks for listening.